between creationists, especially Dr. Henry Morris and Dr. Dwayne Gish of the Institute for Creation Research based in San Diego, they have been challenging evolutionists to debates on college campuses all across the country. And they've been debating this subject in an open forum before the students, presenting the scientific merits of both evolution and creation, comparing them. And, of course, the results have been that the evolutionists are clearly losing the debates, and they're getting worried about it, they're getting upset about it, they're starting to lash out against it. And I think it's an interesting phenomenon. When I first started teaching this course, I wasn't seeing things like that, but it's really exciting for me to see this being spread abroad. I've had the opportunity myself to be engaged in debate on the subject and at a university here in this state. Also at the University of Washington, I've been able to present a seminar on the subject. So things are happening that haven't happened in the past. The doors are opening up in this particular area. Evolutionists are being defeated and exposed, and they're becoming more and more unwilling to debate. The difficult thing now is for creationists to find an evolutionist willing to debate the subject. That's quite a turn of the tables here from what things have been in the past. And I would like to share with you this morning an article that is published by the Institute for Creation Research in a little series that comes out every month called the Impact Series, concerning a debate that was intended to have gone off last year in March, or March of 79, I should say, that never did come about. And I think it will serve to illustrate some of the things I want to share with you about the present situation. It'll illustrate the fact that evolutionists are unwilling to debate, that they have been losing the debates. It will also illustrate the kinds of tactics and techniques that are being used by evolutionists in the mass media to ridicule and discredit the creationists without ever having to deal with the arguments themselves. And this is something we're seeing all the time. And I get articles all the time from magazines, periodicals, newspapers about this creation-evolution controversy. And the thing that I see in almost all of them is that the evolutionists, rather than dealing with the scientific issues involved, and I'll be getting into some of those a little bit later here, are rather trying to focus attention on ridicule, making the creationists seem as though they're outdated, outmoded relics from the Dark Ages that are reverting back to ancient taboos and all this. And using that kind of terminology instead of facing the scientific issues. The reason they're forced to do that, of course, is because if they did face the scientific issues, they wouldn't have a leg to stand on. And that has been demonstrated. And I'd like to read concerning this. The article is called The Delayed Fate of the Dade Debate. The debate was intended to take place in Dade County in Florida between some very noted evolutionary scientists and Dr. Gish and Dr. Morris. And so I'd like to just share with you what took place. Great numbers of students at Miami University and other Dade County, Florida residents were thrilled when the announcement was made of a forthcoming debate between famed evolutionist Sidney W. Fox and Sheldon Greer and ICR creationist Dwayne Gish and Henry Morris, scheduled originally for mid-March 1979. This would be a historic confrontation that should go a long way toward clarifying the relative scientific merits of the two models of origins, with a guarantee of extensive television and newspaper coverage probably nationwide. Especially illuminating would be the interchange between biochemist Fox, Ph.D., Caltech, 1940, and Gish, Ph.D., Berkeley, 1953. Dr. Fox is one of the world's leading evolutionary spokesmen, director of the Institute for Molecular and Cellular Evolution in Miami, famous for his experiments supposedly supporting a naturalistic origin of life. Now, Fox is one of the most highly revered scientists in the world on this subject. Those of you that have taken the class, Dr. Fox was the one that performed the experiments supposedly synthesizing proteinoids, he called them, and so he's very highly respected. Dr. Gish has lectured and debated widely on university campuses in recent years, frequently referring to the Fox experiments as scientifically irrelevant, which they are. Dr. Greer is professor of microbiology at the University of Miami. He studied evolution under top evolutionist Theodosius Dobzhansky, calls evolution the leitmotif of his course in molecular genetics, and is one of the most popular lecturers at the university. If anyone could successfully defend evolutionism against the creationist spokesman, Fox and Greer could do it. The debate was first arranged by John W. Chalfant, a prominent Miami real estate broker and active Christian and creationist, first with Dr. Greer and then with Dr. Fox. The precise date and format were to be determined, but the debate, as such, was accepted, assuming it would be limited to science with no theological cop-outs by the creationists. All this was agreed on early in January, with a tentative date set for March 19th or 20th. Dr. Fox agreed to write to the creationist debaters outlining the precise format he preferred. Instead, however, he contacted the Miami News, which responded with a scathing, sarcastic editorial in its January 20th edition, presenting the issue as one of Dark Ages religious fundamentalism versus enlightened and open-minded modern science. Furthermore, he informed Dr. Chalfant that the debate would have to be postponed until October. The news editorial did confirm, however, that the debate had that the evolutionists had agreed to debate. Dr. Morris responded to the misleading editorial through a letter to the editor published February 2nd. The complete letter is as follows. So this is Dr. Morris's reply to this article that appeared in the Miami News. To the editor of Miami News, the editorial appearing in the news on January 20th entitled Evolving Debate Needs Clarification. It is correct that Dr. Dwayne Gish and I have been scheduled to participate in a creation evolution debate with Dr. Sheldon Greer and Dr. Sidney Fox of Miami University. It is not true, however, that this will be a religious debate. That's what they made it appear to be. Dr. Gish, Ph.D. in biochemistry at Berkeley, and I, Ph.D. in hydraulics, Minnesota, are scientists, not theologians, and we will be discussing only the scientific evidences showing creationism to be superior to evolutionism, explaining the origin and history of life. If anyone talks religion in the debate, it will be the evolutionists, and that's been typically the case. It does require much faith to believe in such a completely unobservable and unreasonable process as the natural evolution of living systems from non-living chemicals, or of complex organisms from simple organisms. Furthermore, we are not proposing that the Book of Genesis or any other religious material be taught in the public schools, nor do we want evolution to be excluded from them. It does seem wrong, however, for young people to be systematically and exclusively indoctrinated in evolutionism, as has been the case in almost all of our public schools for two generations. The scientific arguments and evidences for and against both creation and evolution can be discussed objectively with no reference whatever to the Book of Genesis or to religion. This can be done in the schools just as we propose to do in the debate. What is wrong with giving people a free and informed choice on this vital issue instead of what amounts to religious brainwashing in evolutionary humanism? The editorial noted that, quote, science is responsible for most of the great discoveries of modern civilization, unquote, but missed the important point that evolution is not science. Now, it's true that science has been helpful, but evolution is not science. The greatest scientists, the ones most responsible for the great new discoveries, were creationists. For example, Newton, Hooke, Pascal, Faraday, Maxwell, Pasteur, Kelvin, not evolutionists. None of these men were evolutionists, and they were some of the most highly revered. Most of you that have had any science courses recognize these names. Even today, after decades of exclusive evolutionary teaching in the schools and colleges, there are thousands of scientists who have become creationists, and the number is rapidly increasing, as more and more tough-minded people are taking a careful look at both sides of the question. The Miami News editorial did mention one possible evidence of evolution, quote, fragments of a jaw and teeth, unquote, which Dr. Louis B. Leakey once believed to be an evolutionary ancestor of man. I do hope that Dr. Fox and Dr. Greer can come up with better evidence than this. Half a dozen different preferred evolutionary lineages of man have come and gone since Leakey, and modern evolutionists are still much in disagreement about the true sequence. The real reason why, after multitudes of fossil fragments have been examined and sorted by evolutionary anthropologists for over 100 years, there is still no agreement as to man's evolutionary ancestry is because he had no evolutionary ancestry. All the real evidence indicates that man was true man right from the start. If our modern educators really believed in civil rights, in academic freedom, in scientific objectivity, in religious freedom, and in simple fairness, they would at least allow both sides of this important question to be discussed openly in our schools and universities. Henry M. Morris, Director, Institute for Creation Research. Now, at the same time, Dr. Morris wrote both Dr. Fox and Dr. Greer after first talking with Dr. Fox on the phone, outlining a suggested debate format, stressing an objective and strictly scientific interchange. It was also stressed that any other format preferred by them would be agreeable. In other words, Morris and Gish says, any format you guys want, you can go ahead and have. We don't care what. Let's just debate on the subject. Instead of replying, however, Dr. Fox countered by a letter to the news, published February 20th, in which he indicated that the proposed debate topic was unacceptable. After they'd already agreed on it, he said it was unacceptable. And the debate topic was resolved that the evolution model is more effective than the creation model in correlating and predicting scientific data relative to the origin and history of life on Earth. He accused the creationists of shifting the debate topic from dealing only with evolution to evolution versus creation, which he considered to be bringing theology into the debate. We didn't even want the word creation because that was theology, you see. And so, I won't read the letter here, but Morris and Gish wrote back to him and said, okay, we won't even use the word creation or anything else. We'll just set up the format and just resolve, we'll have the new topic resolved that the theory of evolution is a satisfactory explanation of the scientific evidence related to origins. And so we'll just talk about evolution. Is it satisfactory or is it not? You see, that's a good way to go because if you attack evolution, show that it's impossible, there's only one alternative, and that's creation. That's what I was able to do at the University of Washington. They didn't allow me to speak anything, any theology, any scripture, anything else. But that was no problem, because all I had to do was talk about evolution and show that it was an impossibility, and there's only one alternative. I didn't have to talk about creation. That was obvious. Okay. Now, Dr. Morris also wrote Dr. Fox and Dr. Greer on March 7th, agreeing again to use any debate topic and format that they preferred, and enclosing a copy of the letter sent to the news. In the meantime, Mr. Chalfant indicated, and he's the one who was trying to get the debate together, Mr. Chalfant indicated that he had learned from Dr. Greer that Dr. Greer and Dr. Fox had been receiving much pressure from evolutionists all over the country, urging them either to withdraw from the debate or else to be thoroughly prepared, warning them of a probable defeat and a resulting nationwide setback to evolutionism in the schools. I think that's really significant. The evolutionists all over the country telling these experts, don't debate with these creationists. You'll probably lose and you'll probably set our cause back. Now, I submit that if they have scientific evidence and absolute proof and facts concerning evolution, they shouldn't be afraid of a debate. They should look forward to the opportunity to quench these raving maniacs that are speaking all these blasphemous things, you see. Okay. On March 12th, after receiving Dr. Morris's letter and the letter to the news, Dr. Greer wrote the ICR creationists withdrawing from the debate, using the excuse that he would let Dr. Fox down by being not well prepared. Now, this man was teaching evolution classes in the university and was one of the most popular speakers in the whole campus. And he said that he didn't want to debate because he would not be well prepared, and he felt he'd let the other guy down. This was Dr. Morris replied to him as follows, trying to get him to recant and come back and get into the debate. He says, "Dear Dr. Greer, I was surprised to receive your letter of March 12th asking to withdraw from the evolution debate. It was my understanding that you had eagerly accepted John Chalfant's suggestion to participate and had persuaded Dr. Fox to take part also. I'm sorry to hear of Mrs. Greer's illness, however, and do trust that she will recover soon. If this is the reason for your withdrawal, we certainly understand and sympathize. The other reasons expressed in your letter, on the other hand, are more difficult to understand. If anyone should be capable of giving a scientific apologetic for evolution, it should be you and Dr. Fox. Your reputation as a lecturer on evolution is exceptionally high, and Dr. Fox is known all over the world for his own studies in molecular evolution. Since you both are strong advocates of evolution in the classroom and are involved regularly in evolutionary studies, it should require very little preparation time on your part. I am quite busy myself, college president, etc., but I'm willing to take the necessary time because of the great importance of the issue and the strong public interest in it. Also, we must take strong exception to two other inferences in your letter. The proposed debate has nothing to do with the church and state question. They keep bringing this up. As a Baptist, I strongly believe in the separation of church and state. The debate, as well as the proposed two-model approach in the schools, is to be conducted strictly on a scientific level with no reference to the Bible or religion. Since we have repeatedly emphasized this fact, and since you and Dr. Fox nevertheless continue to say we are trying to discuss religion, we can only conclude that you either question our veracity or else deliberately attempting to confuse the issue. Secondly, you charge us with being with clever distorting of some statement by Dr. Dobzhansky. This allegation, of course, we categorically deny. I'm surprised you would make such a statement without any clarification or documentation. We urge you to reconsider your withdrawal so that this vital question of origins can be openly discussed in a public forum. Otherwise, I hope you will at least retract the two careless charges noted above. If not, would you give us permission to quote your letter and reply to it? Finally, if you still feel you cannot participate in the debate, I would urge you to help Dr. Fox find another partner. Surely, in a great university, there must be two scientists who are able to and willing to defend evolution publicly on a scientific basis. If not, how can the university justify continuing to teach evolution as a scientific fact to all of its students, never requiring that they also hear the other side? Henry M. Morris, Director of Institute for Creation Research. And just a final couple comments. To date, no reply has been received from Dr. Greer. However, Dr. Fox also wrote to Dr. Morris on March 21st, firmly and finally withdrawing from the debate, in a letter that was both patronizing and insulting. Dr. Morris and Dr. Gish had tried to be as courteous as possible in all these interchanges, as well as completely flexible in terms of the debate format and date. Unfortunately, and similar experiences have been recounted by would-be debate sponsors in increasing numbers recently, Dr. Fox and Dr. Greer, for reasons best known to themselves, have decided it best not to confront creationists on a scientific level. So it's quite interesting. That is a typical thing of what has been going on. It's becoming very difficult. There was a recent debate between Dr. Gish and a professor at the University of Washington. And in the debate, this professor was an anthropology professor of social anthropology. He wasn't really a top expert in evolution. It would have been better to have somebody in paleontology or something like that. But he said that none of the other guys would debate. They had tried to go through all the departments of the University of Washington to find somebody who was willing to debate, and this one was the only one that was willing. And he said something like, I'm the latest sacrificial lamb to the creationists, you see. He'd already come into the debate recognizing he was probably going to be defeated, which I think is, again, quite interesting. The thing that's ironic about all this is if this is the attitude that they've got, and if the experts can't find the data and the evidence to overpower the creationists, then how in the world can they expect people to believe this is scientific fact and it's been proven and everything else when they're afraid to bring the issue out publicly and openly? Now, other evolutionists are getting very upset about these things, some downright furious at being challenged and exposed. There's been a lot of articles that have been published in Science magazine, Scientific American. I saw one article in the Humanist magazine was really upset about this creation business because they're so afraid. You see, evolution is absolutely essential to humanism and to communism and to socialism and all these philosophies. And if evolution gets attacked, all of those philosophies are being attacked. And so they're really rising up in arms. And in general, the articles are sarcastic, critical, ridiculing, but no scientific data. I've looked at all of them that I can get my hands on, and I've never read anything I hadn't heard before many, many, many times. Just the same old standard general circumstantial arguments and circular reasoning and so forth. Now, many of them will charge that the creationists are professional debaters. That's one of the excuses. Well, we don't want to debate Gish and Morris. They're professional debaters. They do this for a living, you see. Well, they don't do this for a living. Their primary job is being scientists. But they do want to take advantage of the opportunity to bring this issue out in the public, and they have had a lot of experience debating. But the problem is, most of these that they're challenging debate are college professors. They have been lecturing on these subjects. They've been speaking on these subjects. They're very free with these subjects. They're very dogmatic. They feel quite at liberty to renounce and ridicule creationists in the classroom and to expose their arguments and everything else. So why can't they do it in an open forum? That's all a debate is. They also allege that the creationists are quoting evolutionists out of context. Most of you know that have taken the class that one of the best ways to refute evolution is to quote evolutionists themselves and their own statements and their own admissions about weaknesses in their theories. Well, when you do that, the evolutionists say, oh, you're quoting out of context. But when Gish on several occasions has challenged these people to show me how I'm quoting out of context, give me the real context, show me what I'm doing wrong, they haven't been able to do it. Because most of these quotes are scientific statements, factual scientific statements or opinions or observations that are independent of a lot of contextual qualifications and so forth. And we're very, very careful. I'm very careful in my class to make sure. I'm not telling the people that these guys are creationists. They're evolutionists. That's the reason that their statements are significant, is they are evolutionists, but they're admitting this. Now, many insist that one of the latest articles that's come out has been put out in Discover magazine, another science magazine, May 1981. Dr. Stephen Gould has come up. He's very famous for a more recent revival of the old hopeful monster theory of evolution, the idea that evolution did not occur by slow, gradual modifications, but by sudden jumps, that all of a sudden a rodent was born with wings and was a bat, you see, and that started. The reason that they've had to go to this is because they admit that the transition creatures that you expect from an evolutionary standpoint are missing in the fossil record. And so in order to account for the evolutionary process with no transitional creatures, they've had to go to gigantic jumps in evolutionary development instead of slow, gradual changes. And Dr. Gould is one of those that's advocating that position. But he is furious because creationists will quote Dr. Gould, and rightly so, because he admits that the transition creatures are missing in the fossil record. And so he proposes an explanation for that from an evolutionary standpoint, but he does admit that the transition creatures are missing. Now, creationists quote him in admitting that for perfectly good reasons. They're not inferring that he doesn't believe in evolution anymore. They're just showing that he acknowledges the fact that the transition creatures are missing. That's exactly what the creationists would expect. And the theory that Gould proposes is more full of holes than Darwin's. To suggest macro mutations that have never been observed and sudden gigantic increases in thermodynamic complexity going from no wing to a fully developed wing, fully functioning everything else in one sudden jump is impossible beyond belief. Not only that, but if you're going to have a hopeful monster, you've got to have a hopeful monstrous too so that you can propagate, you see. Otherwise, the hopeful monster would be alone and die alone, and that would be the end of the evolutionary process. So the probabilities of that happening, to get the same mutation and the same macromutation, which is impossibly against the mathematical odds anyway, and to have it happen twice in the same place at the same time, is astronomical beyond all belief, beyond all comprehension. But that's what they're left with, you see, because they're being forced into a hole. And Gould writes in this article, his article, Evolution as Fact and Theory. His tack is a little bit different. What he says is that, yes, it is theory as to how evolution took place, but it's fact that evolution did take place. So don't anybody question the fact of evolution. Evolution's a fact. Now, even if you see us evolutionists disagreeing about certain points of how it took place, evolution's a fact. So there's no question about the fact. It's a fact. Everybody just believe that it's a fact, but we're not quite sure how it happened. Okay. But you see, and let me read you from his own statement here in his article. Well, evolution is a theory. It is also a fact. And facts and theories are different things, not rungs in a hierarchy of increasing certainty. Facts are the world's data. Theories are structures and ideas that explain and interpret facts. That's fine. Facts do not go away when scientists debate rival theories to explain them. That's true, too. Einstein's theory of gravitation replaced Newton's, but apples did not suspend themselves in midair pending the outcome. And human beings evolved from ape-like ancestors, whether they did so by Darwin's proposed mechanism or by some other yet to be discovered. So he insists that evolution is a fact. Even if Darwin's theory doesn't hold up, evolution is still a fact. Now, it's interesting that to support his claim that evolution is a fact, he uses the exact same arguments that we've been refuting in evolution class, the exact same arguments that he also uses to confirm his particular viewpoint as to how it took place. He appeals primarily to the fossil record and to mutations and natural selection. In his case, he's got macromutations and natural selection. And his theory is called the punctuated equilibrium theory, which is a little bit fancier and more sophisticated terminology. In fact, he doesn't like anybody calling it the hopeful monster theory, so I probably shouldn't have said that. But it's a little bit more sophisticated revival of Goldschmidt's theory back in the earlier days. And but his arguments are just the same ones we've used, same ones we've seen. And what he doesn't realize is that creationists do not accept that evolution is a fact, and the issue is it a fact or not? The issue isn't really how it took place. If it never took place, then there's not much fruit to be gained by examining how it might have taken place. And so the issue is, did it take place or not? Now, it's also interesting to examine how it might have taken place, because there you run into absolute impossibilities as well. But the fact is, as we examine the evidence as it is, and the only possible evidence you could have as far as whether or not evolution did take place is the fossil record. You have to have some record of a life in the past. That's the only possible source of information we could go to examine the question of whether or not evolution did take place. And that's precisely the area that creationists focus on. And that's precisely the area that evolutionists also in the past have focused on, but of late are retreating from, because it does not support their theory. Back in Darwin's day, when not many fossils were known, it was easy to speculate that, well, all the transition creatures that are supposed to be there will be discovered in time. But now that we've had 100 and some years to find and look for fossils and have found billions of fossils, but have not found the transition creatures, it's becoming obvious that you better find another explanation for evolution if you're going to still maintain that. And this is why some of these other theories are coming into vogue now. There was recently a gathering of evolutionists at the Field Museum in Chicago discussing this very issue, and there's quite a division and dissension among them, some still favoring the Darwinist idea of slow, gradual modifications, and others going to Gould and Eldridge's theory of this punctuated equilibrium and sudden changes, sudden transformation. That sudden transformation theory has never been very popular because it sounds too much like creation. Sounds too much, like supernatural things involved in a sudden transformation from one type of creature to another, and rightly so. Okay, now, creationists argue that it is not a fact that evolution took place, but it's the interpretation of the data that caused evolutionists to infer that. And the data itself does not lead to such a conclusion. It's only the interpretation and the philosophy behind and the worldview behind the evolutionists that lead them to that conclusion. Ultimately, you see, neither evolution nor creation can be proved scientifically as fact, because they both deal with past unobservable processes. And so, what we're forced to do is to examine the predictions of both evolution and creation and compare them to the data and to see which model fits best. And that can be easily done. And just for a moment here, I'd like to share with you a presentation that I made in a debate concerning this issue. There's two areas that really are focused on and by the creationists generally in debates. You don't have time to go through a lot of detail. So you want to hit the areas that are the strongest and the most significant, the most relevant. And those two areas are first the fossil record itself, and then secondly, the laws of thermodynamics and their implications with regard to evolution. The first of these is dealing with the question, did evolution take place? And let's examine the fossil record and see if there's any evidence that it did take place. And the second is dealing with the question, could evolution have taken place? Is there any possible mechanism for evolution to take place? And that deals with the laws of thermodynamics. So I'll just quickly recount. Some of this will be reviewed for those of you that have taken the class. I'll be throwing in some new information along the way as well. But I just want you to see what the basic tenor of the arguments are during debate. This was my opening presentation in a recent debate. So, introducing by stating the fact that neither view can be proven absolutely, nevertheless, the two ideas can be compared as models of origins based on predictions and expectations of each model and how these compare to the actual fossil record and to known scientific laws. Now, first of all, concerning the fossil record, the creation model holds that most fossils are the result of a catastrophic worldwide flood. They represent organisms that lived basically at one time on the Earth in various ecological zones. Since living things were created separately, we should expect to find fossils of many diversified and highly specialized creatures with a systematic lack of transitional creatures between them. In other words, a systematic meaning that everywhere we look, we find the kinds that we find today, but nothing in between. And all the gaps or all the transitions that the evolutionists would expect to be there should be missing. And we should find after its kind. And, of course, that's exactly what we do find. The evolution model claims that life evolved slowly and gradually over millions of years. Simple life forms, through small mutations preserved by natural selection, evolved into more complex life forms. Since this was a continuous process, the fossil record should be abundant with forms that are transitional between groups of things found living today. By transitional, we mean we should find partially, if suppose a leg developed into a wing, we should find a partial leg wing. We should find a leg that's part leg and part wing, you see. If this happens slowly and gradually over eons of time, we should expect to find partially developed characteristics in all life forms in the fossil record. Since the accepted mechanism for evolution, natural selection, depends on large populations of living things competing for survival, at no time during the course of its evolution should a particular form of life be any more likely to be found as a fossil than at any other time. Since it's a continuous process, there's no special times, the fossil record should not be selective in picking out only the kinds that we have today, but nothing in between. The fossil record should be a random selection of the different living forms in the past, and we should find just as many transitional forms as we find the forms that are living today, if not more. Okay? And there's no argument around that. That's absolutely sound reasoning if evolution really took place the way they claim. For this reason, fossil transitional forms or forms with partially developed characteristics between one group and another should be abundant in the record, regardless of how abundant or rare fossils are. In other words, they should be relatively abundant. Regardless, if you find a few fossils, you should find just as many transitionals as normals. If you find a lot of fossils, you should find as many transitionals as normals. Regardless of I say that because some have alleged that the fossil record is very incomplete and there's only very few fossils. They used to allege that, can't anymore, and I'll quote some evidence on that point. But even if it were scanty, even if we had very few fossils, we should still find as many transitions as the other forms. In fact, more. Now, if there were gaps in the fossil record, they should not be systematic. It would be astronomically improbable that all of the necessary transitional forms should just accidentally be missing from the fossil record. That would be astronomically improbable if evolution took place. The fact is, systematic gaps do appear in the fossil record in agreement with the creation model. While the record is abundant with forms of life that are living today and many that are now extinct but are easily identified with today's classification, the transitional forms between the major groups are missing. The record virtually explodes in the so-called Cambrian era with billions of fossils of highly complex and diversified forms of life, sponges, corals, jellyfish, worms, mollusks, crustaceans, with no ancestors and no transitions between them. That's one of the great mysteries of the fossil record. All of a sudden you have all these diversified forms of life and absolutely nothing before that. No transitional forms. We've got no fossils of one-cell creatures and then multi-cell creatures and then on up the line. We have nothing like that in the fossil record. It starts out with highly complex organisms, greatly diversified right from the very outset. If fish evolved into amphibians, as we're told, it should not be difficult to document the evolution of the fin into a foot and leg. But no such series exists. Birds supposedly evolved from reptiles, but no fossil forms show a foreleg evolving into a wing or scales into feathers. In fact, they claim that scales, feathers and birds evolved from scales and reptiles, but there's absolutely no transitional forms. There's no chemical similarity between scales and feathers. But you see, if you're an evolutionist, what else would they have evolved from? Whales supposedly evolved from land mammals. Now, whales, of course, are a real problem to the evolutionists because they happen to be mammals, breathe air, so forth, and yet they swim in the water. And so, in order to account for this strange quirk of evolutionary history, they claim that the whales were once land animals, that the fish evolved legs, got their legs, moved up out of the water, you know, began to, you know, develop hooves and things and gallop over the plains or climb trees or whatever, you see. And then they didn't like the land. They went back to the water, got close to the edge of the water, spent a lot of time swimming, and all the time swimming, their legs hung uselessly behind, and they withered away, and their tail ends began to develop. Tail flukes and paddles begin to develop, and the breathing apparatus moved around from the mouth to the top of the head, and all the rest you see. Now, if that's the case, if that's true, we should expect to find plenty of transitional forms. I mean, to change legs into paddles, it's going to take some time, and it should be documented very clearly in the fossil record. No such fossils exist. Nothing like that exists. Darwin admitted the problem, but said the record was imperfect. It's easy to blame the data when the data doesn't conform to the theory. Over 100 years of examining the fossil record has failed to improve the situation. I'd like to quote T.N. George in the Science Progress magazine, volume 48, page 1. He says, quote, "There is no need to apologize any longer for the poverty of the fossil record. In some ways, it has become almost unmanageably rich, and discovery is outpacing integration," unquote. Also, an outstanding Swedish scientist, late director of the Botanical Institute in Lund, Sweden, says, quote, "It has been argued that the series of paleontological finds is too intermittent, too full of missing links to serve as convincing proof. If a postulated ancestral type is not found, it is simply stated that it has not so far been found." Darwin himself often used this argument, and in his time it was perhaps justifiable. But it has lost its value through the immense advances of paleobiology in the 20th century. The true situation is that those fossils have not been found which were expected. Just where the new branches are supposed to fork off from the mainstream, it has been impossible to find the connecting types. Now, this is an evolutionist, and he's admitting that they're just not there. They're just not there. He doesn't have any solution. He just says they're not there. At least he's honest. To further document this problem, here's a list of quotations from evolutionists. And here, again, we'd be accused of quoting out of context, but I'll just let you decide that. These are quotations from evolutionists. Every one of them is a quotation from an evolutionist. This comes from the book Evolution of the Christian Faith by David Heiser. It's available on the book counter out there, I believe. And pages 302 to 308. I'm not going to read all of these, but I just want to read you a smattering of quotations to show that the transitional forms that are expected between the various types of living forms are just plain missing, and we have no idea how the course of evolution took place, simply because it didn't. Okay? First of all, concerning life, we do not know how life began, unquote. Protozoa, the so-called one-celled animals, quote, it is not known just what were the ancestors of protozoa, unquote. Metazoa, or many-celled animals, quote, the ancestry of the metazoa is a baffling mystery, unquote. The jellyfish group, we can, of course, only speculate regarding their origin and differentiation, unquote. The unsegmented round worms, quote, from a phylogenetic evolutionary point of view, the relationships of this phylum to other major groups are not exactly clear because they have little in common structurally with other forms of animals, unquote. The arthropods, which includes lobsters, crabs, and insects, quote, the evolutionary origin of the arthropods is hidden in remote Precambrian times. Of course, that's convenient because there's no fossils in Precambrian. Insects. Quote, there is, however, no fossil evidence bearing on the question of insect origin. The oldest known insects show no transition to other arthropods, unquote. Now, I don't know how you can take that statement out of context. It's an unqualified statement. The echinoderms, starfish, sea urchins, etc. Quote, the fossil record of the echinoderms is one of the best, but the record does not throw light upon the origin of the phylum, nor upon its possible relations to other phyla. Unquote. The prochordates, these are the chordates which are not vertebrates. Quote, they stand between the animals without backbones and those with them. But instead of solving the problem of how some backboneless creatures, through the eons, acquired backbones, the prochordates have simply created new problems of their own. Instead of being a key, they turned out to be a headache. In other words, careful study of these animals has failed to reveal the course of evolution. Unquote. The vertebrates, quote, as our present information stands, however, the gap remains unbridged, and the best place to start the evolution of the vertebrates is in the imagination. Unquote. The reptiles, quote, there is no direct proof from the fossil record, but we can readily hypothesize the conditions under which the origin of the reptiles came about. Unquote. No direct proof from the fossil record, but we can readily hypothesize. Of course, anybody can hypothesize. And that's generally what evolution is. It's a lot of hypothesizing and fairy tale stories about how this creature evolved into the next. Birds, quote, nearly a century after the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species, there are still monumental problems that remain to be settled about the succession of life. This is especially true of the birds, unquote. Mammals, quote, the first true mammals were small insectivore types whose relationship to these reptiles is not at all clear, unquote. The cetaceans, the whales and porpoises, quote, Agorophilus exhibits slightly more primitive features but does not furnish any clue to the affinities of whales with any known terrestrial mammalian order, unquote. Horses, quote, the real origin of horses is unknown, unquote. And the horse evolution is considered the best about the evolutionists, but here's the quote, the real origin of horses is unknown, unquote. Another professor, Professor Kirkett, says about the horse evolution that the diagrams you see in the museums are probably only a matter of faith that they're representing the truth, and you don't know whether the diagram represents one tooth or a whole skeleton. And they reconstruct the whole skeleton, of course, but they may have only found a tooth and reconstructed everything else from that, you see. And he's an evolutionist, but he says you can't put any faith or confidence in these things at all. The primates. This includes lemurs, monkeys, apes, and man. Quote, when and where the first primates made their appearance is also conjectural. It is then clear that the earliest primates are not yet known, unquote. Man, quote, there is still no general agreement as to where true Homo sapiens, the men of our species, develop. Each authority has his own theory for which he will fight like a mother for her child, unquote. And then finally, in conclusion, everything, quote, we do not actually know the phylogenetic history of any group of plants and animals since it lies in the undecipherable past, unquote. So that's just a few examples of statements from evolutionists admitting the problem. One of the problems is that evolutionists in their own field, they may see inconsistencies with the theory of evolution, but they believe that everybody else has proved it so thoroughly that they still accept it. But then you go over to the other guy, and he sees inconsistencies, and the other guy sees inconsistencies. They all see inconsistencies, but because they believe that everybody else has confirmed the theory, they all hold to it. And that's one of the woes of specialization in the scientific field today. Another serious flaw in the evolutionary interpretation of the fossil record is the circular reasoning involved. Strata are dated by the fossils they contain. Now, a lot of you are under the impression that a geologist will go out and date a stratified rock formation by radioactive dating or something and determine exactly how old it is. But that is not the case. And it's not determined by how thick the strata is or where its relative position or anything else. The thing that determines the age of strata is the fossils that are found in the strata. That is, they use what they call guide fossils or index fossils. It's the fossils that determine how old the strata is. And how do they know how old the fossils are? Because of the evolutionary sequence that they've assumed, this creature must have evolved so and so millions of years ago, so we'll date the strata that way. Then they'll turn around and use the date that they get for the strata to date the fossil that they found in it, which is pure circular reasoning. And you see, you can decide beforehand anything you want. You can come up with any scheme of evolution if you're going to do that. And it really doesn't matter what order the fossils are in the strata. You would expect simpler fossils to be found deeper in the strata and more complex upper in the upper strata, but that's not always the case. Sometimes it's reversed. We'll talk about that in a moment. So then the ages of the strata are used in the geologic column to demonstrate evolution in a very old Earth. Quoting R.H. Rastall of Cambridge University, who's an evolutionist, quote, it cannot be denied that from a strictly philosophical standpoint, geologists are here arguing in a circle. The succession of organisms has been determined by a study of their remains buried in the rocks, that's the fossils, and the relative ages of the rocks are determined by the remains of organisms that they contain, which is circular reasoning. Date the strata by the fossils and the fossils by the strata. And you can come up with any date that you want as long as you're in agreement, you see. This dating of strata by fossils results in real problems when dealing with so-called upside-down strata. There are large areas in America, Europe, and Asia where strata bearing simple fossils lie on top of those with complex fossils. Now, here's the problem. Evolution says that evolution took place from simple to complex. Simple creatures evolved into more complex creatures. And so, the deeper you dig, the simpler fossils you should find. Obviously, strata that's laid down on top of this one was laid down later than this one. This one was already there before this one is there. And so, the problem is we find strata where complex fossils are underneath the simpler ones. The simpler ones on top and the complex ones beneath. That would mean that complex creatures devolved into simpler ones. And the evolutionist cannot accept that data at face value, so he's got to do something about it. The thing he does about it is introduce great catastrophes. Now, usually they mock and ridicule the creationists for talking about the catastrophe of the flood, but that's really a mild catastrophe compared to what they have to suggest to get the strata reversed in order. One example is Chief Mountain in Glacier National Park. There you have Precambrian limestone resting on top of Cretaceous shale. This would mean that you'd have dinosaurs devolving into trilobites and little bug-like creatures. The strata on top is supposedly 500 million years younger, or the strata on bottom is 500 million years younger than the strata on top. It's just reversed. The explanation is rocks weighing billions of tons slid sideways over younger rocks, in this case about 35 miles. So can you imagine thousands of feet thick strata sliding 35 miles across other strata in order to reverse the order? See, the one strata lifted up and slid over the top of the other, and all the rest of it eroded off, so you have an older one, older fossils on top of the younger fossils. Now, the physical evidence of this is lacking. You would expect great catastrophic physical evidence if this had taken place. We could predict a lot of broken rock in the bedding plane, a lot of other things that just doesn't exist. The strata are very smooth. They look like any other strata anyplace else. It's only the order of the fossils that throws things off. And the physics of such a process is impossible. Quoting Hubbard and Ruby, Bulletin of the Geological Society of America, Volume 70, February 1959, page 126, quote, "Consequently, for the conditions assumed, the pushing of a thrust block, whose length is of the order of 30 kilometers or more, along a horizontal surface appears to be a mechanical impossibility." Now, if you know something about coefficients of friction and the kinds of physics that would be involved in this thing, it would be an impossibility. Some have suggested maybe some oil got trapped and was lubricating so forth, but the physics of that doesn't work either. The oil would absorb into the rock long before it had any effect. And the same is true. I mean, we're talking about thousands of feet thick strata. We're talking about not just a few tons. And the physics of that is just impossible. The Earth would have broken apart if there were any kinds of forces of that nature in effect. Other problems with the fossil record include the existence of polystrate tree trunks penetrating many different strata supposedly laid down over millions of years. There are tree trunks that penetrate stratified layers that each are supposedly laid down millions of years apart, and here goes the tree trunk right through the whole works. Now, obviously, if the strata were laid down millions of years apart, the tree would have rotted long before the other strata would have been able to be laid down. It's clear evidence that those strata were laid down relatively quickly in succession. Also, fossils of human footprints and dinosaur footprints in the same strata in the Paluxy River near Glen Rose, Texas, have been found. This has been clearly documented in the book Genesis Flood by Wickham and Morris. Also, more recent articles have documented further. There's a new book that's coming out concerning these tracks. And there's a film called Footprints in Stone that some of you have seen that documents this as well. Now, the evolutionists, generally, when this is brought up, will say, well, these were tracks that were carved by Indians or carved by people that are trying to sell them to the tourists. Because back in the Depression era, it was a fact that these tracks were known, especially the human tracks. And because many of the human tracks were cut out and sold, some of the enterprisers saw that they were out of tracks, so they began to carve some to sell off to the tourists. And so they say, well, see, it was just a matter of some carved tracks. The problem with that is that recently, just very recently, a team of scientists went down to the area and exposed, they dammed up the river, they exposed the river banks and pulled the strata off the river banks and exposed these same tracks continuing underneath, and there they found very clear human tracks and dinosaur tracks. In one case, a brontosaurus track with a human track right in the brontosaurus track. And there isn't any way the Indians or anyone else is going to carve carvings in strata underneath, you know, many feet of rock and exposed in perfectly undisturbed stratified layers. There isn't any question about that. And the whole thing, it doesn't fit carvings at all. The instep, the impressions, the weight distribution, everything else is exactly what it would be for someone walking in mud. Another way in which the two models might be compared deals with known scientific laws. And so now we're going to talk about the question, could evolution have taken place? The evolution model claims that life evolved by purely natural random processes. and the basic laws of nature that are in effect today. Now, it's the evolutionists themselves that claim that natural laws as we know them today can account for all of the evolution of life. They're the ones that say that. So now what the creationists will do is, let's take a look at the natural laws that we know. Let's look at the laws of physics as they stand today. And let's see if these laws of physics can give us any information as to how evolution might have taken place. One of the two most basic laws of nature is the second law of thermodynamics, which states that in any closed system in which work is being done, entropy increases. That is, the system moves to a state of greater randomness or disorder. Simply put, all the natural processes work toward disorder and decay. Any ordered system left to itself will move toward greater disorder. You're all familiar with this law. Sometimes we refer to it as Murphy's Law. If anything can go wrong, it will go wrong, you see. You're all familiar with this. You let your body go, and what happens? Disorder. You let your room go, what happens? Disorder. Your house go, your car go, whatever, you see. All natural processes move in one direction and one direction only, toward greater disorder. This is one of the most fundamental of all scientific laws. It's been confirmed over and over again. It's never been known to fail. It's the basis for all of modern physics. And that in the first law concerning conservation of energy, they form the basis of all the basic laws that we know. Now, this law says then that all real processes move from order to disorder, from complex to simple, not from simple to complex. Now, mutations, which evolutionists claim are the mechanism for evolution, mutations are random changes in a highly structured, ordered system. Mutations are changes in the genetic code as a result of bombardment by alpha particles, cosmic rays, or chemical reactions or something of that nature. What happens is a cosmic ray will come in and knock part of the genetic code off that highly ordered, structured molecule, and it will damage part of it, and the result of that will be that some characteristic that should have been there will be damaged, altered in some way. Now, the direction in which it will be altered is clear. It's going to be altered in the direction of being worse off rather than better off. You take a high-powered rifle and shoot it into the back of an electronic circuitry in a computer or something, you don't expect a computer to work better afterwards. You know exactly what's going to happen, you see. It's going to always go in one direction. And that's exactly what happens in the genetic system. And experiments have been performed with the fruit flies, and they've exposed them to radiation, and they've gotten mutations, and mutations are things like no wings, shriveled up eyes, shriveled up legs, things of this nature. Most of the mutations are lethal or semi-lethal. They're lethal meaning that they're dead right away, semi-lethal meaning that they'll die very shortly after birth, can't compete. In some cases, if mutation occurs, the parents will actually kill the offspring when they see it's deformed. Now, if that's what you're going to rely upon for the evolution of life from simple to complex, you're in real trouble, because everything is moving in the opposite direction. By the second law of thermodynamics, such random changes to a highly ordered system will result in less order, not more, and make the organism less complex, not more. Experimental data confirms this. No one has demonstrated a mutation that is thermodynamically more complex than before, and I mean no one. Has never been done. Now, you will hear them say that sometimes a mutation has been good, but that's only in cases where, say, a flower was mutated, a red flower was mutated so it had a white form because the pigments were destroyed and it became albino. Well, if you like white flowers better than red flowers, you might call that a good mutation. But thermodynamically, it's not good. Thermodynamically, there is less complex ordered structure in the genetic code than there was before. And in order to have evolution, real evolution, take place, you've got to increase the thermodynamic complexity of the gene structure. And that cannot be done. It has never been observed. Julian Huxley, who's a famous evolutionist, in his book Evolution in Action, admits that at best, 1 in 1,000 mutations are beneficial. Now, he threw out that figure because nobody had found a good one yet, but he's hoping that 1 in 1,000 at best might be beneficial. Later estimates are more like 1 in 100,000, and see, the estimates are difficult because nobody's found one yet. The fact is, as I said, no one has yet observed a genuinely thermodynamically good mutation that has increased the order of the system. Now, Huxley goes on to say that it takes at least 1 million mutational steps to evolve a higher animal. That's a super conservative figure, too. But let's take, and so he calculates the probability then of this taking place. If you've got a probability of 1 in 1,000 for each step, and you've got 1 million successive steps, you have to multiply 1 in 1,000 times itself 1 million times. That gets to be a pretty big number. The number turns out to be 1 chance in 10^3 millionth power. That's a 1 with 3 million zeros after it. In order to write that number out, I would have to have 3 volumes of 500 pages each just to print the number. And that number is beyond any comprehension. That's way beyond all the number of particles in the universe or anything else. I mean, it's way, way beyond that. Once you get up to about 10^50 power, you've already gone beyond any possibility of something occurring. I'll give you a quotation by a mathematician on that in a moment. Now, What does now Huxley is the one that publishes, and then he goes on to say natural selection solved the problem. Because to him, you see, once you get that one good mutation, natural selection will eliminate everybody else, and that will be the only one left, so the whole population will have that good one. And then the next one comes along, and natural selection will eliminate everything else, and that one will be preserved, you see. But if this is taking place, we're going to need a lot more than 4.5 billion years for this process to occur. We're going to need a lot more time than that, because if you've got to go that long with that many, many steps, not only that, but this is awful simplistic reasoning, because suppose you get a good mutation. The next mutation cannot be just any old good mutation. It's got to be the mutation that succeeds this one in the direction toward forming that particular organ and structure. And so every time that you have a mutation, the next one is becoming more improbable and more improbable and more improbable. There isn't any way to calculate how astronomical the probabilities would be of these things coming about by chance. Yet we're supposed to leave it up to natural selection and the mystical powers of nature that have solved all these thermodynamic problems and given us the order of life that we have on the Earth today. Absolute impossibility. And that's purely scientific fact. Now, also, as far as natural selection is concerned, natural selection can operate to some extent, but only on relatively large changes. Small changes will not give any significant advantage to one particular variety over another in the population. Until an organ is completely developed and has a functioning purpose in that creature, it could have no survival value over something else. And so there's no proof that it operates on small changes. And then if you get large changes, usually they're lethal. So you're going to kill anything you get a large change to. So you're really stuck. Not only that, but when you deal with the evolution of life from simple to complex, and when you get to the stages before life has actually evolved, let's suppose increase in order of molecules and eventually forming the first cell, before there's any reproduction, natural selection can't operate anyway. It's not until you have reproduction and competition for survival that it could even operate. So you'd be shot down before you even got to that point, just on the basis of what would be required to take inorganic matter and form a living cell in the first place. Now, even assuming the primeval atmosphere of methane, ammonia, hydrogen, and water vapor, and of course, many of you have heard that these were the gases that composed the original atmosphere of the Earth. Have you ever wondered how they figured that out? Have you ever wondered how they knew that the primitive atmosphere contained methane, ammonia, and hydrogen, water vapor, since it contains only about, water vapor is about the only thing it contains now of these gases? Methane's deadly poison. Ammonia, how'd you like to breathe ammonia? It wouldn't do you any good at all. How did they know that the atmosphere was this way? And of course, they say there was no oxygen, no free oxygen in the primitive atmosphere, even though that's one of the most abundant gases in the atmosphere today. How do they know all these things? Well, only because Stanley Miller performed an experiment in which, with these four gases, he was able to form amino acids. And because amino acids, they're not life, but they are the building blocks of life, they're necessary for life, they assumed that this was the primitive composition of the atmosphere, even though there's absolutely not a particle or shred of evidence that was the case. And so they performed this experiment and hailed this as evidence that life might have evolved by chance. The trouble is that this was a chemical process that is fully in agreement with the laws of thermodynamics, and it required not just putting these gases together and setting a spark to them. You had to set up a very careful apparatus with a cold trap in it to separate out the constituent particles and to separate out the products of the reaction immediately, because if you left them in with the rest, they would be destroyed immediately. As it turns out, the forces that are required to form these amino acids are far more effective in destroying them than in producing them. In fact, it's about 10,000 to 100,000 to 1 in favor of destruction over production, meaning that for every one you produce, you destroy 10 to 100,000. So if we're going to trust in that as the mechanism for how life arose on the Earth, it's absolutely impossible. There is no imagined situation in which you could get a whole ocean full of amino acids like they need under a process like this. It's the intelligence and the ordering agency of man's mind that enables them to separate these things out and to build up a certain constituent, a certain quantity of them. And again, it's only intelligence that can combat the laws of thermodynamics. It has been calculated that one typical protein, suppose you get the amino acids, let's just assume that now, it's an impossibility, but we'll assume it anyway. We get the amino acids. We have oceans of amino acids that are jumbling themselves together and combining in all sorts of different odd combinations, and we're waiting for the right ones to come forth to be the proteins that are necessary to build up life. It has been calculated that one typical protein of 288 units from 12 different amino acids can have 10 to the 300th power different possible combinations. That's one with 300 zeros after it, different possible combinations. Now, you've got to wait until the right combination occurs, because only one will work. And so you're making, and the mass of throw of waste atoms that you would have, or molecules that you'd have, would be bigger than the, would fill the entire universe by the time you got to 10 to the 300th of them. One chance in 10 to 300 power is just, is astronomically impossible for it to ever occur. And that's just for one small protein. We need not one small protein, but a whole system of proteins in a highly complex arrangement, not to mention the DNA and the RNA and the enzymes and all the rest that have to be there as well, that are far more complex than the proteins. Emil Borel, who's a mathematician, said that a chance of less than 1 in 10 to the 50th power has no chance of occurring in this universe in the time available. In other words, once you get up to 10 to the 50th power, considering the number of particles in the universe and the amount of time that the universe has been in existence, even assuming a 6-billion-year-old Earth and so forth as they do, does not give you enough time to expect any chance of such an event ever occurring. So once you get to 10 to the 300th power, something like that, or 10 to the 3 millionth power, as I mentioned before, you can forget it. It's absolutely impossible. Now, while it is often argued that given enough time, anything can happen, 6 billion years is a microscopic drop in a microscopic bucket compared to probabilities like 10 to the 300th power. Okay, I'm just about out of time here. I just want to say one more thing. Some have had questions about the dating, radioactive dating. Some feel that radioactive dating assures us that the Earth is some 4.5 to 6 billion years old, based on uranium, lead, or potassium, argon, one of the radioactive dating methods. Now, I don't have time to go into all the details of radioactive dating. It takes quite a while. But suffice to say this, the method is based on certain assumptions. The problem in the method is not the inaccuracy of a Geiger counter or the inaccuracy of laboratory techniques or anything else. You have some errors there, but they're relatively small compared to the big problem. The big problem is knowing what the initial conditions of the rock were when it was formed. Now, if you assume that the rock was all uranium and no lead when it was formed, then you'll get an age of something like 4.5 billion years. But that's purely an assumption. You don't know how that rock was when it was formed. If God created the rock with lead and uranium in it to start with, the rock may be only 6,000 years old. The rock may be only 5 minutes old, for that matter. There isn't any way we can tell on the basis of what we see now. We have to make an assumption about the initial conditions. Now, it's interesting that they've always assumed, of course, that the Earth cooled from molten state. And in the molten state, the daughter elements of the radioactive process, because they had a different density and different chemical composition and so forth, by convection heating in different densities would separate in the liquid state from the parent elements, from the uranium. And then when they solidified, there was pure uranium in the rock because all the others had separated out. Well, somebody thought of trying this out with known lava flows, because we'd have an analogous situation there with lava that had cooled, and it would be interesting to test known lava flows to see how they registered with the radioactive dating method. And there have been a number of known lava flows, one in Hawaii that was flowed back in 1800 or so, and others in both the United States and Russia, tests like this have been performed. And recent articles have been published along these lines. And as it turns out, lava flows that are known to be only 200 years old, between 100 and 200 years old, historically, we've actually observed them flow and cool. When they dated them with potassium argon and uranium lead, they came up with dates of the order of billions of years for things that were known to be only a couple hundred years old. Now, this caused them to realize that some of the assumptions they were making were wrong. And they found out that, in fact, the convection currents of things don't separate these things out the way they said, and that there are both parent and daughter elements in the material as it's cooled. And that means, then, that any date that you assign to any other rock formation that you see may only be a couple hundred years old. We don't have any idea how old the thing is, because you don't know what the state of the rock was when it was formed. For this one in Hawaii, this was published in the Journal of Geophysical Research in 1968. And this one was one that was known to have flowed in 1800 and 1801. The dates that they got with potassium argon dating ranged from 160 million to 3 billion years for something that was only 168 years old or so at the time that that was done. So, in conclusion, really the only thing we know of in actual practice that can increase order and increase the complexity of a system is intelligence, purpose, design. That's all that we've been able to observe. Without that, everything moves toward disorder and decay. And so if the laws of physics tell us that in order to get increasing complexity, you've got to have intelligence and design, and if there are things in the Earth, in the universe that are very complex, the only conclusion one can draw is that natural processes did not produce this, that there was some sort of intelligence, design, and creator behind the whole thing. It leads you directly to that conclusion. So science, you see, deals with the observable, what we can observe. We can observe the laws of thermodynamics. We can observe the fossil record. And those observations confirm the creationist viewpoint very clearly, the creation model. The observations do not fit what the evolutionists would expect. The evolutionists would expect laws that would indicate some way to get increasing complexity in order. He would also anticipate transitional creatures in the fossil record. Neither one are there. And so it's up to us to make the decision. What are you going to do with the facts that are presented before you? And I don't know of any evolutionist or any person on the face of the earth and can offer you any solid refutation of what I brought here. Some have suggested, concerning the laws of thermodynamics, for example, that the sun's energy supplied the energy for the evolution of life on the earth. That's a preposterous statement. Energy is not the problem. Order is the problem. You can have all the energy in the world, and all it'll do is destroy what you formed. You take a living plant can use the energy of the sun to manufacture food, but it's only because of a highly complex and ordered structure within the plant itself that it's able to use that energy. You take that leaf and cut off its light source, and it dies, it'll wither up. The same energy the sun will dry it right up. And just because you've got gasoline does not mean that gasoline is going to evolve an internal combustion engine to use it. That's what they're saying. The sun's energy is going to evolve some sort of light system to use it. That's preposterous. You've got to have a highly complexly designed internal combustion engine in order for the gasoline to be able to be used at all. You can have a lot of energy, but the energy is not the problem. The order, the complexity of the system is the problem. And when a person makes that statement, I know that he completely misunderstands the laws of thermodynamics. He doesn't know what the problem is. The problem is not energy. The problem is order. And I thank God that we know the truth, that the facts speak for themselves. I'm not at all intimidated by any so-called facts that contest the Word of God. My observations have been, and I've studied this subject deeply and thoroughly for many years, and I'm continuing to take in all the data that I can, but over and over and over again, the facts, the data, confirms the Word of God. It should be expected. God is the one that created the universe. It should be in harmony with what He's spoken in His Word. But I would sure hate to be an evolutionist and have to face a creationist in a debate. That's all I've got to say. I'm really thankful to have the truth. Dr. Gish put it this way, it sure helps in a debate to have the facts on your side. Amen.